would roll, and one of its balls severed the main topmast stay and struck a great lump of wood from the cap. The lump, rebounding from the top, fell onto the gunner's head just as he put it up through the main hatchway. "Lively with those starboard guns," cried Jack. "Helm amidships." He meant to bring the sloop back onto the port tack, for if he could manage to get in another starboard broadside, he would catch the galley as it was moving across from left to right. A muffled roar from number four gun, and a terrible shrieking. In his haste, the sponger hadn't fully cleared the gun, and now the fresh charge had gone off in his face as he rammed it down. They dragged him clear, re-sponged, reloaded the gun and ran it up, but the whole manoeuvre had been too slow. The whole starboard battery had been too slow. The galley was round again. It could spin like a top with all those oars backing water, and it was speeding away to the southwest with the wind on its starboard quarter and its great lateen sails spread on either side. Set in hare's ears, as they say. The cat was now standing southeast. It was half a mile away already, and their courses were diverging fast. The yawing had taken a surprising amount of time, had lost a surprising amount of distance. "Port half a point," said Jack, standing on the lee rail and staring very hard at the galley, which was almost directly ahead of the Sophie, a little over 100 yards away and gaining. "T'gallant stunsails! Mr. Dillon, get a gun into the bows, if you please. We still have the 12-pounders ring-bolts." As far as he could see, they had done the galley no harm. Firing low would have meant firing straight into benches packed tight with Christian rowers chained to the oars. Firing high, his head jerked sideways, his hat darted across the deck. A musket ball from the Corsair had nicked his ear. It was perfectly numb under his investigating hand, and it was pouring with blood. He stepped down from the rail, craning his head out sideways to bleed to windward, while his right hand sheltered his precious epaulette from the flow. "Killick!" he shouted, bending to keep his eyes on the galley under the taut arch of the square mainsail. "Bring me an old coat and another handkerchief." Throughout his changing he gazed piercingly at the galley, which had fired twice with its single after-gun, both shots going a very little wide. "Lord, they run that 12-pounder in and out briskly," he reflected. The t'gallant studding sails were sheeted home. The Sophie's pace increased. Now she was gaining perceptibly. Jack was not the only one to notice this, and a cheer went up from the forecastle, running down the larboard side as the gun crews heard the news.
"The bow chaser is ready, sir," said James Dillon, smiling.
"Are you all right, sir?" he asked, seeing Jack's bloody hand and neck. "A scratch, nothing at all," said Jack. "What do you make of the galley?"
"We're gaining on her, sir," said Dillon.
And although he spoke quietly, there was an extraordinarily fierce exultation in his voice. He had been shockingly upset by Stephen's sudden appearance, and although his innumerable present duties had kept him from much consecutive thought, the whole of his mind, apart from its immediate forefront, was filled with unvoiced concern, distress, and dark, incoherent nightmare shadows. He looked forward to the turmoil on the galley's deck with a wild longing.
"She's spilling her wind," said Jack.
"Look at that sly villain by the mainsheet. Take my glass."
"No, sir, surely not," said Dillon, angrily clapping the telescope shut.
"Well," said Jack, "well." A 12-pounder ball passed through the Sophie's starboard lower studding sails, two holes precisely behind each other, and hummed along 4 or 5 feet from them, a visible blur, just skimming the hammocks. "We could do with one or two of their gunners," observed Jack.
"Masthead," he hailed.
"Sir," came the distant voice.
"What do you make of the sail to windward?"
"Bearing up, sir, bearing up for the head of the convoy."
Jack nodded.
"Let the captains of the bow guns and the quarter gunners serve the chaser. I'll lay her myself."
"Pring is dead, sir."
"Another captain?"
"Make it, sir, Mr. Dillon." He walked up forward.
"Shall we catch him, sir?" asked a grizzled seaman, one of the big boarding party, with the pleasant friendliness of crisis. "I hope so, Cundall, I hope so indeed," said Jack. "At least we shall have a bang at him." "That dog," he said to himself, staring along the dispart sight at the Algerine's deck. He felt the first beginning of the upward roll under the Sophie's forefoot, snapped the match down onto the touch-hole, heard the hiss and the shattering crash and the shriek of trucks as the gun recoiled. "Huzzay! Huzzay!" roared the men on the forecastle. It was no more than a hole in the galley's mainsail, about halfway up, but it was the first blow they'd managed to get home. Three more shots, and they heard one strike something metallic in the galley's stern. "Carry on, Mr. Dillon," said Jack, straightening. "Light along my glass, there." The sun was so low now that it was difficult to see as he stood balancing to the sea, shading his object glass with his far hand, and concentrating with all his power on two red-turbaned figures behind the galley's stern-chaser. A musketoon ball struck the Sophie's starboard knighthead, and he heard a seaman rip out a string of furious obscenity. "John Lake, he copped it something cruel," said a low voice close behind him. "In the bollocks." The gun went off at his side, but before its smoke hid the galley from him, he'd made up his mind. The Algerine was, in fact, spilling his wind, starting his sheets so that his sails, apparently full, were not really drawing with their whole force. That was why the poor old fat, heavy, dirty-bottomed Sophie, labouring furiously and on the very edge of carrying everything away, was gaining slightly on the slim, deadly, fine-cut galley. The Algerine was leading him on. Could, in fact, run away at any moment. Why? To draw him far to the leeward of the cat, that was why. Together with the real possibility of dismasting him, raking him at leisure, being independent of the wind, and making a prize of the Sophie as well. To draw him to the leeward of the convoy, too, so that the sail to windward might snap up half a dozen of them. He glanced over his left shoulder at the cat. Even if she were to go about, they would still fetch her in one board, close-hauled, for she was a very slow creature, no t'gallants and, of course, no royals, far slower than the Sophie. But in a very little while, on this course and at this pace, he would never be able to reach her except by beating up, tack upon tack, with the darkness coming fast. It would not do. His duty was clear enough. The unwelcome choice, as usual. And this was the time for decision. "Vast firing," he said as the gun ran in. "Starboard broadside, ready now. Sergeant Quinn, look to the small arms men. When we have a dead on the beam, aim for her cabin abaft the rower's benches, right low. Fire at the word of command." As he turned and ran back to the quarterdeck, he caught a look from James Dillon's powder-blackened face. A look, if not of anger or something worse, then at least of bitter contrariety. "Hands to the braces," he called, mentally dismissing that as something for another day. "Mr. Marshall, lay her for the cat." He heard the men's groan, a universal exhalation of disappointment, and said, "Hard over." "We'll catch him unaware and give him something to remember the Sophie by," he added to himself, standing directly behind the starboard brass four-pounder. At this speed, the Sophie came round very fast. He crouched, half-bent, not breathing, all his being focused along the central gleam of brass and the turning seascape beyond it. The Sophie turned, turned. The galley's oars started into furious motion, churning up the sea, but it was too late. A tenth of a second before he had the galley dead on the beam, and just before the Sophie reached the middle of her downward roll, he cried, "Fire!" And the Sophie's broadside went off as crisply as a ship of the lines, together with every musket aboard. The smoke cleared, and a cheer went up, for there was a gaping hole in the galley's side, and the Moors were running to and fro in disorder and dismay. In his glass, Jack could see the stern chaser dismounted, and several bodies lying on the deck.
But the miracle hadn't happened. He had neither knocked her rudder away, nor holed her disastrously below the waterline. However, there was no further trouble to be expected from her, he reflected, turning his attention from the galley to the cat. "Well, Doctor," he said, appearing in the cockpit, "how are you getting along?" "Tolerably well, I thank you. Has the battle begun again?" "Oh, no, that was only a shot across the cat's bows. The galley is hull down in the south-southwest, and Dylan has just taken a boat across to set the Norwegians free. The Moors have hung out a white shirt and called for quarter. The damn rogues!" "I am happy to hear it. It is really impossible to sew one's flaps neatly with the jarring of the guns. May I see your ear?" "It was only a passing flick. How are your patients?" "I believe I may answer for four or five of them. The man with the terrible incision in his thigh, they tell me it was a splinter of wood. Can this be true?" "Yes, indeed. A great piece of hard, sharp-edged oak flying through the air will cut you up amazingly. It often happens." "He's responded remarkably well, and I've patched up the poor fellow with the burn. Do you know that the rammer was actually thrust right through between the head of the biceps, just missing the ulnar nerve? But I cannot deal with the gunner down here, not in this light." "The gunner? What's amiss with the gunner? I thought you'd cured him." "So I had. Of the grossest self-induced costiveness it's ever been my privilege to see, caused by a frantic indulgence in Peruvian bark. Self-administered Peruvian bark. But this is a depressed cranial fracture, sir, and I must use the trephine. Here he lies. You notice the characteristic stertor, and I think he's safe until the morning. But as soon as the sun is up, I must have the top of his skull off with my little saw. You will see the gunner's brain, my dear sir," he added with a smile, "or at least his dura mater." "Oh, dear," murmured Jack. Deep depression was settling on him. Anticlimax. Such a bloody little engagement for so little. Two good men killed. The gunner almost certainly dead. No man could survive having his brain open. That stood to reason. And the others might easily die, too. They so often did. And if it hadn't been for that damned convoy, he might have had the galley. Two could play at that game. "Now what's to do?" he cried, as clamour broke out on deck. "They're carrying on very old-fashioned aboard the cat, sir," said the master, as Jack reached the quarter-deck in the twilight. The master came from some far northern part, Orkney, Shetland, and either that or a natural defect in his speech caused him to pronounce ER as AR, a peculiarity that grew more marked in time of stress. "It looks as though those infernal buggers were cutting their capers again, sir." "Put her alongside, Mr. Marshall. Boarders, come along with me." The Sophie braced round her yards to avoid any more damage, backed her foretopsail, and glided evenly along the cat's side. Jack reached out for the main channels on the Norwegian's high side, and swung himself up through the wrecked boarding netting, followed by a grim and savage-looking band. Blood on the deck. Three bodies. Five ashy Moors pressed against the roundhouse bulkhead under the protection of James Dillon. The dumb negro Alfred King with a boarder's axe in his hand. "Get those prisoners across," said Jack. "Stow them in the forehold. What's to do, Mr. Dillon?" "I can't quite make him out, sir, but I think the prisoners must have attacked King between decks." "Is that what happened, King?" The negro was still glaring about. His mates held his arms, and his answer might have meant anything. "Is that what happened, Williams?" asked Jack. "Don't know, sir," said Williams, touching his hat and looking glassy. "Is that what happened, Kelly?" "Don't know, sir," said Kelly, with a knuckle to his forehead and the same look to a hair's breadth. "Where's the cat's master, Mr. Dillon?"
Sir, it seems the Moors tossed them all overboard.
Good God! Cried Jack.
Yet the thing was not uncommon. An angry noise behind him showed that the news had reached the Sophie.
Mr. Marshall, he called, going to the rail, take care of these prisoners, will you? I will not have any foolery.
He looked up and down the deck, up and down the rigging. Very little damage.
You will bring her into Calliope, Mr. Dillon, he said in a low voice, quite upset by the savagery of the thing. Take what men you need.
He returned to the Sophie, very grave, very grave. Yet he had scarcely reached his own quarter-deck before a minute, discreditable voice within said, in that case she's a prize, you know, not just a rescue. He frowned it down, called for the boatswain, and began a tour of the brig, deciding the order of the more urgent repairs. She had suffered surprisingly for a short engagement in which not more than 50 shots had been exchanged. She was a floating example of what superior gunnery could do. The carpenter and two of his crew were over the side in cradles, trying to plug a hole very near the waterline.
"I can't rightly come at him, sir," said Mr. Lamb in answer to Jack's inquiry. "We half drown, but we can't seem to bang an home, not on this tack."
"We'll put her about for you, then, Mr. Lamb, but let me know the minute she's plugged."
He glanced over the darkening sea at the cat, now taking her place in the convoy once more. Going about would mean travelling right away from the cat, and the cat had grown strangely dear to his heart. Loaded with spars, Stettin oak, Stockholm tar, cordage, continued that inner voice eagerly. She might easily fetch 2,000 or 3,000, even 4.
Yes, Mr. Watts, certainly, he said aloud.
They climbed into the main top and gazed at the injured cap.
That was the bit that done poor Mr. Day's business for him, said the boatswain.
So that was it. A devilish great lump indeed, but we must not give up hope. Dr. Maturin is going to do something prodigious clever with a saw as soon as there's light. He needs light for it. Something uncommonly skilful, I dare say.
Oh, yes, I'm sure, sir, cried the boatswain warmly. A very clever gentleman he must be, no question. The men are wonderfully pleased. How kind, they say, to saw off Ned Evans' legs so trim, and to sew up John Lakey's private parts so neat, as well as all the rest, he being, so to speak, on leave. A visitor-like.
It is handsome, said Jack. It is very handsome, I agree.
We'll need a kind of gammoning here, Mr. Watt, until the carpenter can attend to the cap. Hawsers bowsed as tight as can be, and God help us if we have to strike topmasts.
They saw to 6 other points, and Jack climbed down, paused to count his convoy, very close and orderly now after its fright, and went below. As he let himself sink onto the long cushioned locker, he found that he was in the act of saying, carry 3, for his mind was busily working out 3/8 of £3,500. It had now fixed upon this sum as the worth of the daughter Engelbrecht's data. For 3/8, less one of them for the Admiral, was to be his share of the proceeds. Nor was his the only mind to be busy with figures by any means, for every other man on the Sophie's books was entitled to share. Dillon and the master, an 1/8 between them. The surgeon, if the Sophie had officially borne one on her books. Boatswain, carpenter and master's mates, another 1/8. Then the midshipmen, the inferior warrant officers and the marine sergeant, another 1/8. While the rest of the ship's company shared the remaining quarter. And it was wonderful to see how briskly minds not given to abstract thought rattled these figures, these symbols, up and down, coming out with the acting yeoman of the sheet share correct to the nearest farthing. He reached for a pencil to do the sum properly, felt ashamed, pushed it aside, hesitated, took it up again and wrote the figures very small,
diagonally upon the corner of a leaf, thrusting the paper quickly from him at a knock on the door. It was the still-moist carpenter, coming to report the shot-holes plugged and no more than 18 inches of water in the well, which is less nor half what I expected with that nasty rough stroke the galley gave us, firing from so low down. He paused, giving Jack an odd, sideways-looking glance. "Well, that's capital, Mr. Lamb," said Jack after a moment. But the carpenter didn't stir. He stood there dripping on the painted sailcloth squares, making a little pool at last. Then he burst out, "Which, if it's true about the cat and the poor Norwegians dumped overboard, perhaps wounded too, which makes you right mad as being mere cruelty, what harm would they do if battened down? Howsoever, the warrant officers of the Sophie would wish the gentleman," jerking his head towards the night cabin, Stephen Maturin's temporary dwelling place, "cut in on their share fair dues as a mark of, as an acknowledgement of his conduct, considered very handsome by all hands." "If you please, sir," said Babington, "the cat's signalling." On the quarter-deck, Jack saw that Dylan had run up a motley hoist, obviously all the daughter Engelsbrecht data possessed, stating, among other things, that he had the plague aboard and that he was about to sail. "Hands to wear ship," he called, and when the Sophie had run down to within a cable's length of the convoy, he hailed, "Cat ahoy!" "Sir," came Dylan's voice over the intervening sea, "you will be pleased to hear the Norwegians are all safe." "What?" "The Norwegians are all safe." The two vessels came closer. "They hid in a secret place in the forepeak." "In the forepeak," went on Dylan. "Oh, fuck their forepeak," muttered the quartermaster at the wheel, for the Sophie was all ears, the very religious hush. "Full and by," cried Jack angrily, as the topsail shivered under the influence of the quartermaster's emotion. "Keep her full and by."
"Full and by it is, sir."
"And the master says," continued the distant voice, "could we send a surgeon aboard, because one of his men hurt his toe hurrying down the ladder?" "Tell the master from me," cried Jack in a voice that reached almost to Calliope, his face purple with effort and furious indignation. "Tell the master that he can take his man's toe and fuck with it." He stumped below, £875 the poorer, and looking thoroughly sour and disagreeable. This, however, was not an expression that his features wore easily or for long, and when he stepped into the cutter to go aboard the Admiral in Genoa Roads, his face was quite restored to its natural cheerfulness. It was rather grave, of course, for a visit to the formidable Lord Keith, Admiral of the Blue and Commander-in-Chief in the Mediterranean, was no laughing matter. His gravity, as he sat there in the stern sheets, very carefully washed, shaved and dressed, affected his coxswain and the cutter's crew, and they rowed soberly along, keeping their eyes primly inboard. Yet even so they were going to reach the flagship too early, and Jack, looking at his watch, desired them to pull round the Audacious and lie on their oars. From here he could see the whole bay, with 5 ships of the line and 4 frigates 2 or 3 miles from the land, and inshore of them a swarm of gunboats and mortar vessels. They were steadily bombarding the noble city that rose steeply in a sweeping curve at the head of the bay, lying there in a cloud of smoke of their own making, lobbing bombs into the close-packed buildings on the far side of the distant mole. The boats were small in the distance. The houses, churches and palaces were smaller still, though quite distinct in that sweet, transparent air, like toys. But the continuous rumbling of the fire and the deeper reply of the French artillery on shore was strangely close at hand, real and menacing. The necessary 10 minutes passed. The Sophie's cutter approached the flagship, and in answer to the hail of boat ahoy, the coxswain answered Sophie, meaning that her captain was aboard. Jack went up the side in due form, saluted the quarterdeck, shook hands with Captain Louis, and was shown to the Admiral's cabin. He had every reason to be pleased with himself. He had taken his convoy to Cagliari without loss, he had brought up another to Leghorn, and he was here at exactly the appointed time, in spite of calms off Monte Cristo. But for all that, he was remarkably nervous, and his mind was so full of Lord Keith that when he saw no admiral in that beautiful, great, light-filled cabin, but only a well-rounded young woman with her back to the window, he gaped like any carp. "Jackie, dear," said the young woman, "how beautiful you are, all dressed up. Let me put your neckcloth straight. La, Jackie, you look as frightened as if I were a Frenchman." "Queenie! Old Queenie!" cried Jack, squeezing her and giving her a most affectionate smacking kiss. "God damn and blast! A legget corpus Sweeney!" cried a furious Scotch voice, and the Admiral walked in from the quarter-gallery. Lord Keith was a tall, grey man, with a fine leonine head, and his eyes shot blazing sparks of rage. "This is the young man I told you about, Admiral," said Queenie, patting poor, pale Jack's black stock into place and waving a ring at him. "I used to give him his bath and take him into my bed when he had bad dreams." This might not have been thought the very best possible recommendation to a newly married admiral of close on 60, but it seemed to answer. "Oh!" said the Admiral. "Yes, I was forgetting. Forgive me. I have such a power of captains, and some of them are very mere rakes." "And some of them are very mere rakes," says he, piercing me through and through with that damned cold eye of his, said Jack, filling Stephen's glass and spreading himself comfortably along the locker. And I was morally certain that he recognised me from the only 3 times we were in company, and each time worse than the last. The first was at the Cape in the old Rezzo, when I was a midshipman. He was Captain Elphinstone then. He came aboard just 2 minutes after Captain Douglas had turned me before the mast and said, "What's yon wee snotty bairn a-greeting at?" Then Captain Douglas said, "That wretched boy's a perfect young whoremonger. I've turned him before the mast to learn him his duty."
"Is that a more convenient place to learn it?" said Stephen.
"Well, it's easier for them to teach you deference," said Jack, smiling, "for they can seize you to a grating at the gangway and flog the liver and lights out of you with the cat. It means disrating a midshipman, degrading him so that he is no longer what we call a young gentleman, but a common sailor. He becomes a common sailor. He berths and messes with them, and he can be knocked about by anyone with a cane or a starter in his hand, as well as being flogged. I never thought he'd really do it, although he'd threaten me with it often enough, for he was a friend of my father's, and I thought he had a kindness for me, which, indeed, he did. But, however, he carried it out, and there I was, turned before the mast. And he kept me there 6 months before rating me midshipman again. I was grateful to him in the end, because I came to understand the lower deck through and through. They were wonderfully kind to me on the whole, but at the time I bawled like a calf, wept like any girl.
What made him take so decided a step?
Oh, it was over a girl, a likely black girl called Sally, said Jack. She came off in a bumboat, and I hid her in the cable tier. But Captain Douglas and I had disagreed about a good many other things, obedience mostly, and getting out of bed in the morning, and respect for the schoolmaster. We had a schoolmaster aboard, a drunken sot named Pitt, and a dish of tripe. Then the second time Lord Keith saw me was when I was 5th of the Hannibal, and our first lieutenant was that damn fool Carroll.
"'If there's one thing I hate more than being on shore, "'it's being under the orders of a damn fool that's no seaman. "'He was so offensive, so designedly offensive, "'over a trivial little point of discipline "'that I was obliged to ask him whether he'd like to meet me elsewhere. "'That was exactly what he wanted. "'He ran to the captain and said I'd called him out. "'Captain Newman said it was nonsense, but I must apologise.' But I couldn't do that, for there was nothing to apologise about. I was in the right, you see. So there I was, hauled up in front of half a dozen post-captains and two admirals. Lord Keith was one of the admirals. What happened? Petulance. I was officially reprimanded for petulance. Then the third time... Oh, but I'll not go into details, said Jack. "'It's a very curious thing, you know,' he went on, gazing out of the stern window with a look of mild, ingenuous wonder. "'A prodigious curious thing. "'But there cannot be many men who are both damned fools and no seamen "'who reach post-rank in the Royal Navy. "'Men with no interest, I mean, of course. "'And yet it so happens that I've served under no less than two of them. "'I really thought I was dished that time.' Career finished, cut down. Alas, poor Borwick. I spent 8 months on shore, as melancholy as that chap in the play. Going up to town whenever I could afford it, which wasn't often, and hanging about that damned waiting room in the Admiralty. I really thought I should never get to sea again. A half-pay lieutenant for the rest of my life. If it hadn't been for my fiddle... And fox-hunting when I could get a horse, I think I should have hanged myself. That Christmas was the last time I saw Queenie, I believe, apart from just once in London. Is she an aunt, a cousin? No connection at all. But we were almost brought up together, or rather, she almost brought me up. I always remember her as a great girl, not a child at all. Though to be sure there can't be 10 years between us. Such a dear, kind creature. They had Damplow, the next house to ours. They were almost in our park. And after my mother died, I dare say I spent as much time there as I did at home. More, he said reflectively, gazing up at the telltale compass overhead. You know Dr. Johnson? Dictionary Johnson? "'Certainly,' cried Stephen, looking strange. "'The most respectable, the most amiable of the moderns. "'I disagree with all he says, except when he speaks of Ireland, "'yet I honour him, and for his life of savage I love him. "'What is more, he occupied the most vivid dream I ever had in my life not a week ago. "'How strange that you should mention him today. "'Yes, ain't it?' "'He was a great friend of theirs until their mother ran off and married an Italian, a papist. "'Queenie was wonderfully upset at having a papist to her father-in-law, as you may imagine. "'Not that she ever saw him, however. "'Anything but a papist,' says she. "'I should rather have had Black Frank 1,000 times, I declare. "'So we burnt 13 guys in a row that year. "'It must have been 83 or 84, not long after the Battle of the Saints.' After that they settled at Damplow more or less for good, the girls, I mean, and their old she-cousin. Dear Queenie. I believe I spoke of her before, didn't I? She taught me mathematics. I believe you did. A Hebrew scholar, if I do not mistake. Exactly so. Conic sections and the Pentateuch came as easy as kiss my hand to her. Dear Queenie, I thought she was to be an old maid, though she was so pretty. For how could any man make up to a girl that knows Hebrew? It seemed a sad pity. Anyone so sweet-tempered should have a prodigious great family of children. But, however, here she is, married to the Admiral, so it all ends happy. Yet, you know, he's amazingly ancient. Grey-haired, rising 60, I dare say. Do you think, as a physician, I mean, is it possible? Possibilissima. Eh?
possibile le cose naturali,
sang Stephen in a harsh, creaking tone, quite unlike his speaking voice, which was not disagreeable.
Esse Susanna vuol possibilissima.
Discordantly, but near enough to Figaro to be recognised. Really? Really? Said Jack with intense interest. Then, after a pause for reflection, we might try that as a duetto. Improvising. She joined him at Leghorn, and there I was, thinking it was my own merit, recognised at last, and honourable wounds, laughing heartily, that had won me my promotion, whereas I make no doubt that it was all dear Queenie, do you see? But I haven't told you the best, and this I certainly owe to her. We are to have a 6 weeks' cruise down the French and Spanish coast as far as Cape Nau. I? Well, that'd be good. Yes, yes, very good. No more convoy duty, you understand. No more being tied to a lubberly parcel of sneaking rogues, merchants creeping up and down the sea. The French and the Spaniards, their trade, their harbours, their supplies. These are to be our objects. Lord Keith was very earnest about the great importance of destroying their commerce. He was very particular about it indeed. As important as your great fleet action, says he, and so very much more profitable. The Admiral took me aside and dwelt upon it at length. He's a most acute, far-sighted commander. Not a Nelson, of course, but quite out of the ordinary. I'm glad Queenie has him. And we're under no one's orders, which is so delightful. No bald-pated pantaloon to say, Jack Aubrey, you proceed to Leghorn with these hogs for the fleet, making it quite impossible even to hope for a prize. Prize money! He cried, smiling and slapping his thigh, and the marine sentry outside the door, who had been listening intently, wagged his head and smiled too. "Are you very much attached to money?" asked Stephen. "I love it passionately," said Jack, with truth ringing clear in his voice. "I've always been poor, and I long to be rich." "That's right," said the marine. "My dear old father was always poor too," went on Jack, "but as open-handed as a summer's day. He gave me £50 a year allowance when I was a midshipman, which was uncommon handsome in those days. Or would have been had he ever managed to persuade Mr. Hoare to pay it after the first quarter. Lord, how I suffered in the old rezzo. Mess bills, laundry, growing out of my uniforms. Of course I love money. But I think we should be getting underway. There's two bells striking." Jack and Stephen were to be the gunroom's guests, to taste the sucking pig bought at Leghorn. James Dillon was there to bid them welcome, together with the master, the purser, and Mowat, as they plunged into the gloom. The gunroom had no stern windows, no sash ports, only a scrap of skylight right forward. For although the peculiarity of the surface construction made for a very comfortable captain's cabin, luxurious, indeed, if only the captain's legs had been sawn off a little above the knee, unencumbered with the usual guns, it meant that the gunroom lay on a lower level than the spar deck and reposed upon a kind of shelf, not unlike an orlop. Dinner was rather a stiff, formal entertainment to begin with, although it was lit by a splendid Byzantine silver hanging lamp taken by Dillon out of a Turkish galley, and although it was lubricated by uncommonly good wine, for Dillon was well-to-do, even wealthy by naval standards, everyone was unnaturally well-behaved. Jack was to give the tone, as he knew very well. It was expected of him, and it was his privilege. But this kind of deference, this attentive listening to every remark of his, required the words he uttered to be worth the attention they excited.
A wearing state of affairs for a man accustomed to ordinary human conversation, with its perpetual interruption, contradiction, and plain disregard. Here, everything he said was right. And presently his spirits began to sink under the burden. Marshall and Purser Ricketts sat mum, saying please and thank you, eating with dreadful precision. Young Mowat, a fellow guest, was altogether silent, of course. Dylan worked away at the small talk, but Stephen Maturin was sunk deep in a reverie. It was the pig that saved this melancholy feast. Impelled by a trip on the part of the steward that coincided with a sudden lurch on the part of the Sophie, it left its dish at the door of the gunroom and shot into Mowat's lap. In the subsequent roaring and hullabaloo, everyone grew human again, remaining natural long enough for Jack to reach the point he'd been looking forward to since the beginning of dinner. "Well, gentlemen," he said, after they had drunk the king's health, "I have news that will please you, I believe. Though I must ask Mr. Dillon's indulgence for speaking of a service matter at this table. The Admiral gives us a cruise on our own, down to Cape Nau. And I have prevailed upon Dr. Maturin to stay aboard, to sew us up when the violence of the king's enemies happens to tear us apart." "Huzzay! Well done! Hear, hear! Topping news! Good! Hear him!" they cried, all more or less together. And they looked so pleased. There was so much candid friendliness on their faces that Stephen was intensely moved. "Lord Keith was delighted when I told him," Jack went on. "Said he envied us extremely, had no position in the flagship. Was amazed when I told him of the gunner's brains. Called for his spyglass to look at Mr. Day taking the sun on deck, and wrote out the doctor's order in his own hand, which is something I have never heard of in the service before. Nor had anyone there present. The order had to be wetted. 3 bottles of port, there, Killick. Bumpers all round. And while Stephen sat looking modestly down at the table, they all stood up, crouching their heads under the beams, and sang, 'Huzzay, huzzay, huzzay! Huzzay, huzzay, huzzay! Huzzay, huzzay, huzzay! Huzzay!' There is only one thing I do not care for, however," he said as the order was passed reverently round the table, "and that is this foolish insistence upon the word surgeon. Do hereby appoint you surgeon. Take upon you the employment of surgeon, together with such allowance for wages and victuals for yourself as is usual for the surgeon of the said sloop. It is a false description, and a false description is anathema to the philosophic mind." "I am sure it is anathema to the philosophic mind," said James Dillon, "but the naval mind fairly revels in it, so it does. Take that word sloop, for example." "Yes," said Stephen, narrowing his eyes through the haze of port, and trying to remember the definitions he'd heard. "Why, now, a sloop, as you know, is properly a one-masted vessel with a fore and aft rig, but in the Navy a sloop may be ship-rigged. She may have 3 masts." "Or take the Sophie," cried the master, anxious to bring his crumb of comfort. "She's rightly a brig, you know, Doctor, with her 2 masts." He held up 2 fingers, in case a landman might not fully comprehend so great a number. "But the minute Captain Aubrey sets foot in her, why, she too becomes a sloop, for a brig is a lieutenant's command." "Or take me," said Jack. "I'm called captain, but really I'm only a master and commander." "Or the place where the men sleep, just forward," said the purser, pointing. "Rightly speaking, an official, 'tis the gun deck, though there's never a gun on it. We call it the spar deck, though there's no spars neither. But some say the gun deck still, and call the right gun deck the upper deck. "'Or take this brig, which is no true brig at all, "'not with her square mainsail, "'but rather a sort of snow, or a hermaphrodite.'
"'No, no, my dear sir,' said James Dillon. "'Never let a mere word grieve your heart.' We have nominal captain servants who are in fact midshipmen. We have nominal able seamen on our books who are scarcely breached. They're 1,000 miles away and still at school. We swear we've not shifted any backstays when we shift them continually. And we take many other oaths that nobody believes. No, no. You may call yourself what you please so long as you do your duty. The Navy speaks in symbols, and you may suit what meaning you choose to the words. Chapter 5. The fair copy of the Sophie's log was written out in David Richards' unusually beautiful copperplate, but in all other respects it was just like every other logbook in the service. Its tone of semi-literate, official, righteous dullness never varied. It spoke of the opening of beef cask number 271 and the death of the loblolly boy in exactly the same voice, and it never deviated into human prose even for the taking of the sloop's first prize. Thursday, June 28th. Winds variable, southeast by south, course south 50 west, distance 63 miles. Latitude 42 degrees 32 minutes north, longitude 4 degrees 17 minutes east, Cape Creus south 76 degrees west 12 leagues. Moderate breezes and cloudy PM at 7 in first reef topsails, AM ditto weather, exercising the great guns. The people employed occasionally. Friday, June the 29th. South and eastward. Light airs and clear weather. Exercising the great guns. PM employed worming the cable. AM, moderate breezes and clouds in third reef main topsail, bent another foretopsail, and close reefed it, hard gales at 4, handed the square mainsail at 8, more moderate reefed the square mainsail, and set it. At noon, calm. Departed this life, Henry Gouge's loblolly boy. Exercised the great guns. Saturday, June 30th. Light airs inclinable to calm. Exercised the great guns. Punished John Shanahan and Thomas Yates with 12 lashes for drunkenness. Killed a bullock, weight 530 pounds. Remains of water, 3 tons. Sunday, July the 1st. Mustered the ship's company by divisions, read the articles of war, performed divine service, and committed the body of Henry Gouges to the deep. At noon, ditto weather. Ditto weather. But the sun sank towards a livid, purple, tumescent cloud bank piled deep on the western horizon, and it was clear to every seaman aboard that it was not going to remain ditto much longer. The seamen, sprawling abroad on the forecastle and combing out their long hair, or plaiting it up again for one another, kindly explained to the landmen that this long swell from the south and east, this strange sticky heat that came both from the sky and the glassy surface of the heaving sea, and this horribly threatening appearance of the sun, meant that there was to be a coming dissolution of all natural bonds, an apocalyptic upheaval, a right dirty night ahead. The sailormen had plenty of time to depress their hearers, already low in their spirits because of the unnatural death of Henry Gouges,
I'd said, "Ha-ha, mates, I'm 50 years old this day. Oh, dear." And had died sitting there, still holding his untasted grog. They had plenty of time, for this was Sunday afternoon, when, in the course of nature, the forecastle was covered with sailors at their ease, their pigtails undone. Some of the more gifted had queues they could tuck into their belts. And now that these ornaments were loosened and combed out, lank when still wet, or bushy when dry and as yet ungreased, they gave their owners a strangely awful and foreboding look, like oracles, which added to the landsman's uneasiness. The seamen laid it on, but with all their efforts they could scarcely exaggerate the event. For the southeasterly gale increased from its first warning blasts at the end of the last dog watch to a great roaring current of air by the end of the middle watch, a torrent so laden with warm rain that the men at the wheel had to hold their heads down and cup their mouths sideways to breathe. The seas mounted higher and higher. They were not the height of the great Atlantic rollers, but they were steeper, and in a way more wicked. Their heads tore off, streaming in front of them, so as to race through the Sophie's tops, and they were tall enough to becalm her as she lay there a-try, riding it out under a storm staysail. This was something she could do superbly well. She might not be very fast. She might not look very dangerous or high-bred. But with her topgallant mast struck down on deck, her guns double-breached and her hatches battened down, leaving only a little screened way to the after-ladder, and with 100 miles of sea-room under her lee, she lay to as snug and unconcerned as an eider-duck. She was a remarkably dry vessel, too, observed Jack, as she climbed the creaming slope of a wave, slipped its roaring top neatly under her bows, and travelled smoothly down into the hollow. He stood with an arm round a backstay, wearing a tarpaulin jacket and a pair of calico drawers. His streaming yellow hair, which he wore loose and long as a tribute to Lord Nelson, stood straight out behind him at the top of each wave, and sank in the troughs between. A natural anemometer. And he watched the regular, dreamlike procession in the diffused light of the racing moon. With the greatest pleasure he saw that his forecast of her qualities as a sea-boat was fulfilled and, indeed, surpassed. "She is remarkably dry," he said to Stephen, who, preferring to die in the open, had crept up on deck, had been made fast to a stanchion, and who now stood mute, sodden, and appalled behind him. "Eh? She is remarkably dry." Stephen frowned impatiently. This was no time for trifling. But the rising sun swallowed up the wind, and by 7:30 the next morning all that was left of the storm was the swell and a line of clouds low over the distant Gulf of Lyons in the northwest. The sky was of an unbelievable purity, and the air was washed so clean that Stephen could see the colour of the petrel's dangling feet as it pattered across the Sophie's wake some 20 yards behind. "I remember the fact of extreme prostrating terror," he said, keeping his eye on the tiny bird. "But the inward nature of the emotion now escapes me." The man at the wheel and the quartermaster at the con exchanged a shocked glance. "It is not unlike the case of a woman in childbirth," went on Stephen, moving to the taffrail to keep the petrel in view and speaking rather more loudly. The man at the wheel and the quartermaster looked hastily away from one another. This was terrible. Anybody might hear.
the Sophie's surgeon, the opener, in broad daylight and upon the entranced main deck of the Gunner's Brain Pan, Lazarus Day, as he was called now, was much prized. But there was no telling how far he might go in impropriety. I remember an instance.
"Sail ho!" cried the masthead, to the relief of all upon the Sophie's quarterdeck.
"Where away?"
"To leeward. 2 points, 3 points on the beam. A felucca. In distress, her sheets are flying."
The Sophie turned, and presently those on deck could see the distant felucca as it rose and fell on the long, troubled sea. It made no attempt to fly, none to alter course, nor yet to heave to, but stood on with its shreds of sails streaming out on the irregular breaths of the dying wind. Nor did it show any answering colours or reply to the Sophie's hail. There was no one at the tiller, and when they came nearer, those with glasses could see the bar move from side to side as the felucca yawed.
"That's a body on deck," said Babington, full of glee.
"It'll be awkward lowering a boat in this," remarked Jack, more or less to himself.
"Williams, lay her along, will you? Mr. Watts, let some men stand by to boom her off. What do you make of her, Mr. Marshall?"
"Why, sir, I take it she's from Tangiers, or maybe Tetuan, the west end of the coast at all events."
"That man in the square hole died of plague," said Stephen Maturin, clapping his telescope to. A hush followed this statement, and the wind sighed through the weather shrouds. The distance between the two vessels narrowed fast, and now everyone could see a shape wedged in the after hatchway, with perhaps two more beneath it. An almost naked body among the tangle of gear near the tiller.
"Keep her full," said Jack.
"Doctor, are you quite sure of what you say? Take my glass."
Stephen looked through it for a moment and handed it back.
"There is no possible doubt," he said. "I'll just make up a bag and then I'll go across. There may be some survivors."
The felucca was almost touching now, and a tame jennet, a usual creature in Barbary craft on account of the rats, stood on the rail, looking eagerly up, ready to spring. An elderly Swede named Volgardsen, the kindliest of men, threw a swab that knocked it off its balance, and all the men along the side hooted and shrieked to frighten it away.
"Mr. Dillon," said Jack, "we'll get the starboard tacks aboard." At once the Sophie sprang to life. Bosun's calls shrilling, hands running to their places, general uproar. And in the din, Stephen cried, "I insist upon a boat. I protest." Jack took him by the elbow and propelled him with affectionate violence into the cabin. "My dear sir," he said, "I am afraid you must not insist or protest. It is mutiny, you know, and you would be obliged to be hanged. Was you to set foot in that felucca, even if you did not bring back the contagion, we should have to fly the yellow flag at Mahon, and you know what that means. 40 mortal bloody days on the quarantine island, and shot if you stray outside the palisado, that's what. And whether you brought it back or not, half the hands would die of fright."
"You mean to sail directly away from that ship, giving it no assistance?"
"Yes, sir."
"Upon your own head, then?"
"Certainly."
The log took little notice of this incident. It scarcely could have found any appropriate official language for saying that the Sophie's surgeon shook his fist at the Sophie's captain in any case. And it shuffled the whole thing off with the disingenuous spoke felucca and 11:15 tacked. For it was eager to come to the happiest entry it had made for years. Captain Allen had been an unlucky commander, Not only had the Sophie been almost entirely confined to convoy duty in his time, but whenever he did have a cruise, the sea had emptied before him. Never a prize did he take. P.S.